In Proverbs 20, we come to a chapter. Again, Proverbs has a lot of themes in every chapter that you could go at. But in this particular chapter, there are a number of verses that to me merge into helping us come to an honest assessment of our own lives. Proverbs 19, we looked at the state of the soul. Proverbs 20, similarly, it's another view into the soul and an honest assessment. And of course, the Lord is the only one that really knows our lives, our hearts. Solomon, the wisest man alive, said that God alone understands the hearts of people in 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 39, if you're taking notes. And Jeremiah said, I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind. He's the one that knows us. And it's incumbent to us to pray, Lord, search my heart. Try me. See if there's any wicked way within me, as David prayed. But in coming to an honest assessment of ourselves, many people have a difficulty with that. It's difficult. It's not an easy thing. It's not easy to be honest and, to really see some things that perhaps aren't pleasant. Many people opt out for the easy path. They would much rather just bury their problems in alcohol or drugs and just forget about them and not grow, not have to go through the character development, not face their fears or their problems, but to bury them. And so we come to the exhortation here, really. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. Liquor is personified as to what people do here under its influence, mocking and brawling. Because essentially what you're doing is that, you know, you come to a place where you're not growing anymore. You become dependent. That's why so many alcoholics are so dependent, and the only thing they can do is use manipulation to get what they want. They're like babies who have ceased maturing. The tranquilizing effect of the alcohol keeps them from developing and growing. So naturally they become like children. And in many respects, everything is revolved through self. They don't have any opportunity to understand others because they're so filled with themselves. Naturally, they're going to mock. And eventually what you'll find is as you get two people in a bar that are both drinking, they're both going to mock and they're both going to be the little gods of their own little world. And the gods are going to run into each other eventually and they're going to end up fighting and striving. This so happens. Alcohol is one of those things that it's actually a depressant, though we think it stimulates us. It stimulates us by knocking out the higher centers of your brain. It depresses the judgment and the common sense and things like that so that your baser desires are expanded. And now you feel like, hey, I'm the life of the party here. You know, I'm really doing good. I'm cool. And you don't see yourself. You become a mocker and a brawler. You led astray by it, you're not wise. You know, how many young women have lost their virginity under the influence of alcohol? How many men have contracted a sexually transmitted disease because they're not reasoning things through because they're under the influence of alcohol? Years ago, I knew a leader in a church who was inflamed by wine at a wedding. He had a couple of glasses and he helped his daughter's friend home because she had too much to drink. And as he was helping her into her bed, he, inflamed by the wine, had touched her. And then the desire arose and he went back in the room and touched her some more and eventually lost his opportunity to minister. It cost him his reputation and his ministry, all because of the foolishness of becoming under the influence of something else. You know, it stunts personal development. It keeps you in a place where you can't grow. Verse 2, of course, if you're under an inflated view of yourself, it might lead also to incurring the anger of one in authority. In verse 2, we see the wrath of a king is like the roaring of a lion. Whoever provokes him to anger sins against his own life. In those days, kings had absolute power. So you really weren't dealing with a full deck if you provoked the king, because you're going to be in trouble. Now, we look at this and it makes sense. It's common sense. Sure, I understand that. It's not really smart. You're sinning against your own life. But how many people actually consider this about the King of Kings? They provoke the King of Kings with their life. Now, God is infinitely patient. He is so patient. He's not willing that any should perish. The Bible says he won't always strive with us. There's going to come a time when he's going to confirm us in our decision we've made. And if we keep running from him and mocking him and rejecting him, eventually he will allow us to make that choice and it will be permanent. And you're only hurting yourself, though. when you fight against the authority of God. Roaring of a lion, obviously, is just meant to liken to the danger of a lion. You know, lions are very aggressive. I had the unique opportunity on a missions trip to Africa to take a day to go out on a safari in Kenya. And it was an amazing experience as we saw animals out there, hundreds of miles of nobody or nothing except for animals. And we came across a couple of young lions. We didn't see the big lions there. And a couple of young lions were by the side of the road. And we pulled about maybe 100 yards up ahead of them. And I said, stop, I want to get out. So I got out and I wanted to see if I could spook these young lions. You know, they weren't that big. So I kind of moved like this real jerkingly toward them and yelled. And the young lions perked up and instead of being spooked, they started running toward me. They thought I was some food source, I guess, or something, but they weren't afraid. I got in that car, well, let's get out of here. But lions are very aggressive. And, of course, it wouldn't be very smart to provoke. And some of you are thinking, why did you do that? And I look back and I did many impetuous things when I was younger. Verse 3, it is honorable for a man to stop striving since any fool can start a quarrel. You know, in some cultures, there's this foolish honor code that makes revenge an honor. That if someone insults you, you know, you pull out your little white glove and I slap them on the face and say, I challenge you to a duel. And people actually will fight to the death over being insulted and their pride being affected. You know, any fool can start a quarrel, but it's honorable to stop. It's honorable to see where it's going, to have a little prudence to know where that argument is leading. You know, the wise won't be drawn into quarrels. There's patience and understanding and restraint. And if you feel slighted, you don't feel you have to defend yourself. But any fool gets uppity about things. Verse 4, a lazy man will not plow because of winter. He will beg during harvest and have nothing. A sluggard always finds an excuse. Later on, you're going to find one excuse that's particularly funny. The sluggard says, there's a lion in the streets. And here he says, it's too cold. It's winter. You know, I'm too cold to get out there. So it's winter, he won't get out there. And springtime, when the lions start coming out, there's lions in the streets. So when is he going to work? Well, the point is, it's not a matter of really that. It's just a matter of an excuse. But what's going to happen? Well, he's going to beg during harvest. You know, there was a man who told his doctor he wasn't able to do all the things he used to do around the house that his wife wanted him to do. And so he went in for the examination. When it was complete, he says, Doc, look, I'm a man. I can take it. Whatever it is, just tell me in plain English what's wrong with me. The doctor says, well, in plain English, you're just plain lazy. And the man says, okay, I can accept that. But could you give me the medical term so I could tell my wife? We don't want to own up to things, do we? And here is a guy who he's got excuse after excuse after excuse why he's not working. But in the end, he's not going to have what he needs. Now, again, you can make some spiritual comparisons to this as well. Spiritually, it takes time and effort to dig into the Word of God, to gain some knowledge and understanding about the Lord. You know, you ought not to treat coming to church as your whole meal for the week. This should be just a dessert, just gathering together and celebrating with the saints, fellowshipping and hearing the Word of God. This is just the top of the what should be at your own home. I mean, if you come here for dessert, you should have some home cooking at home. You should really get into the Scriptures and study. And you know what? You get out of it what you dig in, because the Bible is like that. It's shallow enough for the smallest babe to come and get a drink, but it's deep enough for the deepest theologian to never fathom the bottom. And you'll get out of it what you put in of effort and desire, of desiring to know more about the Lord. Dig, seek, and you'll find. Knock, and the door shall be open to you. But many people say, well, it takes too much time. I'm too busy to read and study and pray and fellowship or share my faith. But blessed are those who have sown much. They're going to reap much. And you spend the time. If you want a harvest, especially a spiritual harvest, you're going to need to do a little bit of sowing some seeds. And not take excuses as this man does. Verse 5, counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. Literally, counsel is also translated the motive. It's also translated the inner thoughts, the inner workings of the heart of man. It's like deep water. Like deep water, not a shallow pool, but a deep water. There's a lot of stuff underneath the surface. Now, those who have a lot of wisdom underneath the surface are not going to likely advertise it. Those with wisdom don't usually advertise it. Look, I'm very wise, you know, follow me. They're usually quiet, and it takes a man of understanding to draw that out. Also, those with ulterior motives may not be readily seen on the surface, but a man of understanding can draw it out. He can see what's really there. Paul the Apostle was able to see and told the Philippians, you know, that there were those who preached Christ from envy and strife. He saw the motive behind it. There are those who actually want to serve God, but their motive is self-centered. They have ego needs. They want to be seen, or they want to be noticed, or in some capacity they get a joy out of having people look up to them. But that's not a true calling, you see. God is the one that can search our heart out, and yet here is a man of understanding can draw it out. You've heard it said, probably, what you see is what you get. And we always hear that quoted as if that's a positive thing. I wonder sometimes, is it positive? If all you get is what you see on the surface, that's a problem. There are people in this room, there are people sitting right next to you with a wealth of wisdom, a wealth of learnings and lessons and growing in the Lord that would be awesome friends. And you may not ever know if you don't have the understanding to draw out from people. You know, so much of our fellowship is so surface. It's like, you know, we're walking to church. Hey, how you doing? Hey, I'm good. Fine. You know, you're fine. I'm fine. We're the church of the fine people. You know, everybody's fine. And that's about as deep as we get. And then we see each other next week. If that's your relationships, you're in trouble. You need to have a deeper, you know, understanding of people, getting knee to knee, face to face with people, getting in the home groups, getting plugged in a way that's going to really be a benefit to you. Because, you know, it's a deep well. People are deep wells. Water source is invisible to the naked eye. It's like a desert in a way. If you go out in the desert, it doesn't look like you could survive. Where's the water? What am I going to drink? But those who have a little bit of know-how can find water anywhere, literally anywhere. I took, it was one of those fill-in courses in college. It was a wilderness survival course. And I got a kick out of it because literally something stuck with me. If I were in the desert, I could get water. All I would need is like a 4x4 foot sheet of plastic and a cup. That's all I'd need. And I'd have all the water to drink in the desert. Because what you do is you dig this big hole. You pull all these plants, chop them up, put them in the bottom of the hole, and put the cup right in the center. Then you put the plastic over the top, you hold it in place with rocks, and you put one single little rock in the center so it creates kind of a cone right over the cup. And all the plants from the hot sun will start, you know, condensing all the water to the top, and it'll drain right into the cup. And in a day's time, you can get a couple of quarts of water that way and survive. Now you'll never forget that. But you know what? It's not readily seen on the surface. It's just like people. There's so many things you don't see on the surface with people's lives. So many things that you don't understand or notice until you really take the time to get to know someone. You know, I love getting to know different people, and you sit down, you say, tell me your story. And you know, you hear how they came to the Lord and the things that God has done in their life. And man, that is so exciting. You know, it's deep. Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water. A man of understanding will draw it out. Now, on the surface, verse 6, most men will proclaim each his own goodness. See, that's what you'll see on the surface. And this is human nature, isn't it? We're going to proclaim our own goodness. We're not going to let anybody know our bad points right away. We're going to proclaim where we're good. Now, verse 6 here, this word goodness is a rich word, actually, that is more than just the Hebrew word kesed is kindness, mercy, generosity. It implies a lot of these things. And we're very quick to promote ourselves in that. But who can really find a faithful man? Solomon said he found 1 out of 1,000 men who were worth their salt. And he said, I don't know if he was sexist, but he says, out of 1,000 women, he couldn't find one. You can take it up with Solomon on that one. And he should know about women. He had 1,000 wives, or 700 wives and 300 concubines. But probably that's why he had so much trouble with women, because he should have only had one, but that's another story. The point is, we are very quick to see in ourselves what's good. And a lot of times others, when they take the time to get to know us, they're going to find a little bit more about us. We're very quick to point out our good points, but we really, when you think about it, who can find a faithful person? You know, finding a faithful friend, true value once you find it. But love and mercy are common enough on the outside in some degrees, and everyone parades what they've got. But when you really see who's truly faithful, there's not a whole lot. Verse 7, the righteous man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. You leave a legacy whether you realize it or not. You leave a legacy one way or another. The repercussions of your decisions in this life right now are going to affect the next generation. How your children view, you know, this is the hard part about this. You can go down to you can even get on the web pages certain statistics about society. You can find out, you know, how many people do this, what happens to them, how many people smoke, how many people get cancer from that. You can look and track down so many statistics, but there's one statistic that's impossible to track down. And that is the impact on society that isn't there because of what is left undone. You know, if you do an act, you can track that down and see how many things happen as a result of that act. But what do you know about those things that you leave undone? The things that you should do but you don't do, and the people that aren't impacted that could have been impacted, and the people they could have impacted if they were impacted by you. Think of the things in society that we miss because of undone things. Here's a righteous man walking in integrity. You know, it's hard. It's hard not to do the wrong thing when you're tempted. It's hard to be honest when everyone else is cheating and getting away with it. It's hard to be honest in business and compete against those who cheat because they have an advantage in that sense. Righteous man walks in his integrity, though, and you know where the real legacy lies is his children. They're blessed after him because they now have the benefit of having a father and a mother that are people of integrity, people of their word, and that's a strong legacy to leave them. Let that be the stamp on your family integrity. King who sits on the throne of judgment scatters all evil with his eyes. And this is what the Lord intended with authority. There's a safety in authority. All authority comes from God, according to Romans 13. And the authority doesn't bear the sword for nothing. It's important. It puts a fear in the people's eyes about doing wrong. I mean, a lot of us do right because we're afraid of getting caught. You go the speed limit or just a little bit over the speed limit, because you know if you go too far over the speed limit, you'll get a ticket and the repercussions of that, especially in New Jersey with the insurance rates. You know that every ticket's going to cost you about $500 to $600 after all said and done. It's not worth it. A few extra minutes. So because of the authority, it keeps you in check. It scatters evil. It does its effect. That's the point. Verse 9, who can say, I have made my heart clean. I am pure from my sin. We are often oblivious to our own motives unless the Lord shows us. And unless there was a universal standard, what is right and wrong, we'd be hopelessly blind to our condition. Who can say I've made my heart clean, though? I'm pure from my sin. Can anyone come to that place and say that? I'll tell you, you can say I have been declared righteous by the grace of God through his sacrificial gift by sending his son to die for me. You can say your sin is removed because of what God did for you, but you can't say, I have made my heart clean. I am pure from my sin. You know, in fact, the more godly you are, the more conscious you'll be of that flesh, that striving, self-centered flesh. Like Isaiah, when he had an encounter with God, and though he was a counselor to six kings, godly, powerful prophet. Yet when he saw the Lord, he said, woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. He was conscious of himself. Job, righteous Job, says, I abhor myself in dust and ashes. Paul, the most mighty of all the apostles, the most educated, the most well-read, the most used, said, I am the chief of sinners. See, the more you grow with the Lord, the farther you would get away from declaring yourself that you have risen up and by your righteousness done anything. Because by the righteousness of man, no one will be justified. It's only by what God has imputed to you through the gift of salvation. You know, only the Lord can cleanse us. And as the psalmist prayed, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from sin. Psalm 51. Purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. Wash me and I'll be whiter than snow. That's our prayer. Verse 10, diverse weights and diverse measures, they are both alike an abomination to the Lord. You know, here we are trying to look good. We proclaim our own loyalty. We're saying, I've made my heart clean. And now you come to this verse 10, diverse weights and measures. Now, when you went to the store back in those days, of course, you didn't go with denominations of 10s and 20s and 50s, you know, in your pocket or quarters. And, you know, nothing was labeled. It was by weight. You had a handful of change, but it was by weight you would buy. There was no denominations on it. What they would do then to cheat you is they would have various standard weights that were shaved off a little bit. So you really weren't getting true value. And they had different weights. Some weights for buying, some weights for selling, depending on what they wanted to do. Well, diverse weights, that is, that type of dishonesty is a deception. It's an abomination to the Lord. But the very fact that you're using various weights is a testimony of yourself. You're saying, what I'm doing is wrong. Because if it wasn't wrong, you wouldn't have to pretend. You wouldn't have to fake it. You wouldn't have to deceive. You're admitting what I'm doing is really wrong. And yet you're pretending to someone. Here's a guy who's got various weights. So you go to the store and you want a shekel's worth of lettuce. So you put your shekel's worth out there and they weigh it, and you're not getting the true value for that. But he goes on and throws a little bit more of the bigger head for you because, you know, he's a nice, generous guy. And all the time he's ripping you off while he's making it seem like he's generous. And you'll go, I like that guy. Yeah, he's real generous. He gives me extra. And you don't know, he's ripping you off. God hates that type of deception. Even a child is known by his deeds, whether what he does is pure and right. It's by your deeds in the end you'll be judged. Not by what you say of yourself, but what you do. You know, that's what the real evaluation is. You know, not by what you say, but what you do. Even a child. As a young kid, when I was 4 years old and living in my grandmother's home, she took me to this, it was kind of a Bible story hour class. I remember Mrs. Vreeland, about five houses down from us. Sweet old lady that opened up her garage. She had a nice little area there set with chairs, and she used to teach Bible stories. And of course, one of the motivations that I went was because she used to tape a quarter under one of the chairs. And so if you sat in that right chair, you got a quarter. And I always wanted to find the quarter and, you know, just never seemed to get that right chair. And one day she caught me coming in early, looking under all the chairs to see if I could find it. And she made me memorize this verse. And this was one of the verses that I did memorize as a little kid. You know, even at 4 years of age, even a child is known by his deeds. I can still say it. Even a child is known by his deeds. I can still remember saying that. But it's true. What we are is what we're doing, not what we're saying. We're unique creatures. Animals, we judge them by their actions, not by their speech, because they don't have speech. But we often try to figure out a person by their speech if we don't know their actions. But even a child is known by his deeds. You know, actions speak louder than words. The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. What wonderful gifts the Lord has given to us. Windows to the world. You know, hearing and seeing is such an amazing thing. When you really stop and think about it, I really get weary of the evolutionary dogma that speaks about how we developed over eons of time, and all these systems that we have in our body took millions and millions of years to develop. I get weary of hearing it. You hear a lie loud and long enough, you begin to believe it after a while. But it's so hard to see how these complex systems. Your ear, for example, is quite an amazing thing. The ear canal in a human is the exact length to... It's 1 inch, which gives the resonance frequency of approximately 3,400 hertz, which is the exact range in which to understand speech. Now, other animals have much better frequency pickup than we do. they don't need to have this range because they don't understand speech anyway, so that they hear other things. We're made, God created us just so that we could understand speech. It would make sense to us. And the tympanic membrane and the incus and the cochlea and the vestibular labyrinth and the organ of Corte and the tectorial membrane and the outer hair cells and all these little things about the ear that I just happened to look at the anatomy of this week amazes me. I mean, I was reading about how these things come together. These membranes pick up the sound signals and it transmits to these some 12,000 outer little hairs in the cochlea that these filaments pick up the stimulation and they send the signal to the brain. This is so complex. It's amazing. Any little one thing that's wrong and you can't hear. And all the features, all the little bones and the various nerve endings had to be in place all of a sudden, all at once, as one complete package. How do you develop that? How do you develop that? All those things at once. It's not like one thing was developed and says, oh, we need a bone over here. You know, okay. How would it know? To me, it is an amazing gift. But even more than that, there is much more to seeing than what we see with our eyes. Jesus uses this as a metaphor for seeing spiritually and hearing spiritually. He spoke about the Pharisees. You've got ears to hear, but you don't hear. You've got eyes to see, but you don't see. They don't perceive. People all around us don't perceive. They're centimeters, like an unborn child is centimeters away from the real world, yet has ears and eyes, but can't perceive the outside world, being just centimeters away. This is how people are who are not born again. They're right there. The kingdom of God is in their midst, but they can't perceive it until they're born. Then they have eyes to see and ears to hear. Spiritual sight and hearing are very special gifts. And to make the most of your senses, verse 13. Don't love sleep lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you'll be satisfied with bread. You know, sleep and its accompanied relatives, such as TV, which is really packaged sleep. We've got the Technicolor dreams right there produced in front of us. We don't have to dream. We've got the dreams already made for us. But that's what it is. It puts us in the state of just not having any thinking. We're not using our senses. We need to open our eyes and be satisfied with bread. I mean, in a real practical way, if a guy likes to sleep, he's going to come to poverty. If he's too tired to get up and go to work, he's not going to be able to feed himself. Spiritually, it's similar too. Open your eyes. Take the time to discern the things of God, and you're going to be satisfied more than you can imagine. It is good for nothing, cries the buyer. When he has gone his way, then he boasts. Just another creative way to lie. And there are many creative ways to be dishonest, and here is one of them. You know, I've got a lot of scratches on this car over here, fella. I'm going to have to repair. That's going to probably cost about $500. I'll just take $400 off of this. And we start getting this car, you know, attacking all the little things around it. And we finally get the guy down to his rock bottom price. And we go away. And then we boast like crazy. You can't believe it. I stole it from this guy. Well, that seems to be what we accept in our, you know, culture. But I don't think it's a right thing. Here it's dishonest. Good for nothing, says the buyer. When he goes away, he boasts. He's not being honest. Not an honest assessment. There's gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. Gold and a multitude of rubies. What people sell in order to get gold and rubies. What they sacrifice in order to get wealth, fame. But you know, the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. Education, we know, is very important. Give a guy a fish, you can feed him for a day. Teach him a fish, you can feed him for a lifetime. Education is very important. But spiritual education is far more valuable than any other education. Lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. Take the garment of one who is surety for a stranger, verse 16, and hold it as a pledge when it is for a seductress. Now, we've already seen this idea in Proverbs about being surety for a stranger, being a guarantee for somebody you don't know. You know, it's like you've impressed with some new acquaintance, and yet you ought not to become a guarantee for them. Not a wise thing. You don't know them that well. You know, it's in many respects. Now, here's an interesting dilemma, though. Here he's saying, take the garment of one. Here's the guy who's become surety for a stranger. The stranger didn't pay his debt. Now he has to pay it. And him, he's got nothing to pay, so his garment has to go. Now in the Old Testament law, there's an interesting law that forbids anyone who is owed a debt to take the garment from someone at night. And if you do, you have to take it during the day and give it back to him at night so he doesn't get cold at night. But it was God's way of protecting the poor and the unfortunate. But here it's almost like you can protect the poor and unfortunate, but for the unsufferably stupid, just let them suffer. Why? Shouldn't we suffer the consequences of dumb decisions? Doesn't that help us make less dumb decisions? Hey, I think of the decisions I've made that cost me a lot, and I thank God for suffering the consequence, because I can tell you one thing, I'm not going to do that again. That's all a part of learning and growing. Here, this man has done a really foolish thing. He's guaranteed for some stranger he doesn't know, and the stranger's walked out on the debt. Now he's got to pay it. He's co-signed for this guy that he doesn't even know. Now he's got to pay the debt. Well, he's going to pay it even if it takes his garment. And especially if it's for a seductress, you know, when the money is used for even evil purposes. But the point is here, there's a certain accountability that each of us should have in regard to the choices we make. Verse 17, bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth will be filled with gravel. Sweet in the beginning, but in the end, the conscience begins to kick in. You begin to really be unhappy with that. Verse 18, plans are established by counsel, and by wise counsel wage war. Thinking ahead, planning ahead, count the cost. Life is complex. It's difficult sometimes. It takes time to really plan things out. And the Lord would want us to count the cost before we make a decision, to think through what our decision is to follow Him. Well, His words are my counselors, and each day we all go to war. We're in a battle, whether we realize it or not, a spiritual battle. And the wisdom of God isn't just going to happen by osmosis. You're going to need to sit down at the table. You know, if you were a king back in those days and you had an army coming at you with 20,000 men, Jesus used as a parable, and you've only got 10,000, you've got to count the cost. Do you have enough? Do you have some strategy that's going to allow you to overcome those 2-to-1 odds? If so, then work that strategy. Weigh it out. Can you do it? Try it then. But if you just went headlong into it, as many Christians do each day, thinking, waking up in the morning, you're a little bit late for work, run out, start making decisions as if you have enough wisdom to deal with life in all its complexity. You know, you're going to war without counsel. You're going to be a statistic. You will be a casualty if you keep doing that. You might have gotten lucky a few times. You might have, you know, been covered with some decision that you made. But you keep doing it, it's only a matter of time before a piece of shrapnel hits you, because you didn't plan more wisely, and you spend that time in the Scriptures. Verse 19, a passage we've seen often in the Proverbs, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets, therefore do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. Whoever curses his father or his mother, his lamp will be put out in deep darkness. We saw the positive side. The fifth commandment is the only commandment with a promise. If you honor your father and your mother, you'll live long on the earth. Here, the negative side of that is, if you don't, you won't. Your lamp will be put out in deep darkness. You know, to me, it's shocking how kids these days treat their parents. Now, the rebellion is already there in the heart of a child. But, you know, when our society encourages it, it doesn't make it easy. You know, in fact, that's the problem with people. We like the weird things, you know, the odd things in life. You know, the Ripley's Believe It or Not shows. You know, the stranger, the more attractive. You know, we'll watch somebody eat a live crab. Oh, I can't believe he's doing that. You know, it's like, oh, show me more, you know. That's how we are as people. And that's why television programs naturally need some quirky, some weird twist on life in order to attract an audience. So you can't have a Leave It to Beaver family, you know, or the Waltons anymore. It's just, although my wife likes watching that, but most people, they get bored with just the normalness of life. They want to have some quirky change on it. So they mix up the family structure and they throw the kids in that are, you know, these precocious little pre-adolescents that are, you know, sharp as a wit, and usually parents that are dull as anything. And you know, and it just makes an interesting, quirky type of a thing. Problem is, kids think this is the real world. And they begin thinking, I can talk to my parents that way. Parents are stupid. They don't know anything. And you know what? You've got to hold them to account on that. Rude, sarcastic remarks may be funny by a pre-adolescent, but because it's so unreal. But if they see it often enough, it's becoming more and more widespread. We're seeing the results in society. Here's what the Lord says. You know, your lamp will be put out in deep darkness. An inheritance gained hastily at the beginning will not be blessed at the end. Anything you gain, easy come, easy go. This is the implication in this verse, however, is dishonest gain hastily. It's not going to be blessed at the end. There have been those who have hastily gained, like Joseph, who was raised from being a prisoner to second in command, and David, raised from being a shepherd to being king, but they went through periods of preparation, learning and trusting in the Lord when they had nothing. Here is just a get-rich-quick scheme. It's worked, but it really won't bless them in the end. Do not say, I will recompense evil. Wait for the Lord, and He will save you. Again, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. We should repay no one evil for evil. You see, revenge only rises when faith is absent. When we can't see how the Lord sees. When we only see the problem. But with faith, we see the evil as a favor from the Lord to maneuver us into a position of greater blessings. You know, shouldn't we look at life that way? So that person lied to get the promotion above you. And you should have gotten that promotion, but they got it because they lied about something, and you got the short end of the stick. Now you feel in your heart like taking a little revenge. You feel like settling the score a little bit. But as a godly person, you see, the Lord says, don't say that you'll recompense evil. Wait on the Lord. He'll save you. He'll take care of it. You know, I think for everything that hits us, I always like to see how God's going to work it out. And that's how I want to look at things. And this is really what the Lord wants us to do. But we can only do that if we're walking by faith, trusting that the Lord is faithful. He's working it out. When you take matters into your own hands, it's because you're really not believing or trusting God. You think you've got to do it. And let me tell you something. You can't do as good a job as God. He can do much better. Again, diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and dishonest scales are not good. A man's steps are of the Lord. How then can a man understand his own way? We have this perplexing problem to figure out. We can wake up in the morning and choose to have Wheaties or Post Toasties. We can choose to do this or do that. We can choose a variety of things in life. We can go to work or not go to work. We have freedom to choose. We can go the direction we want to go. But here's the interesting thing. God is sovereign. Everything that happens, God is going to weave into the plan that He has already designed. It's from His perspective, you see, it's already done because He's in the past, present, and future all at once. He knows everything. From our perspective, when we start thinking that way, we start getting fatalistic. And, you know, we think, well, nothing I do matters anymore. No, that's not true. This is the mystery. This is the puzzle. Your choices have a great deal to do with what's going to happen, yet God is going to work out His plan. I look at it this way. God is going to unfold His plan. I can be a part of the good side or the bad side. The way I look at it this way is every knee is going to bow one day before the Lord and confess Jesus is Lord. But for some, it'll be too late to enjoy the blessing of that. It'll be more like acknowledging it once it's too late. You die in your sin, and then you're going to see who God is, and you're going to confess He is Lord, but you're going to be on the outside of that. Here's the steps of a man. Or a man's steps, they're really of the Lord. We make a choice, yet we don't see how God works it out. I think of the history of how God worked. Israel's circuitous route to get to the Promised Land was perfect. It was God-ordained, even though it didn't make sense to them. Philip, in a revival in Samaria, he is led of the Lord by the Spirit to go out in the desert. Why? Yet God knows he has an appointment with an official from Ethiopia. It's interesting how Chuck Smith desired to stay a few more years in Huntington Beach to pastor there because he loved to surf. And he'd come to the end of his 2 years worth of sermons, didn't have any more sermons. Every 2 years he had to go to a different place. And yet he didn't want to leave because he liked to surf. What am I going to do? And he found these expository sermons by this pastor to take people through the scriptures, you know, expositorially. In other words, letting the scriptures, instead of making a sermon up with all of your ideas, you do what we're doing, going through verse by verse or coming with a text. And he did this, and in 1 year's time, his church doubled. And he stumbled on this, and he began to just teach through the Bible and come to a book and get the commentaries and learn about that book and then teach the book. And his church doubled, and it kept doubling every year. The funny thing is, it was all because he just loved to surf. A man's steps are ordered by the Lord. It's like God is the one that really is working behind the scenes, even in our natural desires sometimes. How can we understand our way? How can we figure this all out? Well, the point is, the answer to that is we can't. We're called to just, all right, make the decision that's right now, that the Lord would honor the Lord right now, and he'll work it out. It's a snare for a man to devote something rashly as holy and then afterward to reconsider his vows. Talk to Ananias and Sapphira about that one. There in Acts, when everyone was getting excited about the working of God and they wanted to give toward the work, and Ananias and Sapphira saw everybody selling their property and giving money to the Lord, and they said, hey, you know, that guy's doing it. So they sold their property, but instead of giving it to the Lord, they pretended to give it all, but they kept back some. Now, there was no requirement. They didn't have to give anything. They didn't have to. But by doing it in pretense, you know, it was wrong. They lied against God. And, of course, there in Acts 6, it describes what happened. You know, they lost their lives. Yieldedness is more than just a flash of devotion, which would make for a rash vow. I wouldn't want you to get all hyped up, you know, and all stirred up. And there, you know, churches often will set a budget based on the pledge of each member, and sometimes they will get these professional, you know, fundraisers in to work the people up to make these big pledges so they can now have a bigger budget. And the problem with that is you get carnal motivation coming in. I wouldn't want anybody to be fleshly motivated to give. There's going to be no names on the backs of pews. There's not going to be any bricks with your names on it. There's not going to be any carnal motivation, you know, because it would be motivating, wouldn't it? Ooh, I'll get my name on a brick. That would be cool. You know, sure, I'll get $5,000 a brick. You know, it's a lot of money, but boy, I have my name on it. It'll be there, you know. Ooh, okay. So people get motivated this way. And it is a powerful motivator because we like to see our name in bricks, I guess. I don't know. My problem, though, is that I don't believe that's what the Lord would want. Because you get rash vows that way. You get people saying, well, I'll give this, I'll give that. You know, I think the Lord wants us to purpose in our minds, in our hearts ahead of time. As I said last week, you know, it's, if you're just thinking when the offering's passed of what you might want to put in then, it's really too late. You should know ahead of time in your whole budget, where is the Lord's portion? What do you want? What do you purpose in your mind right now? In putting your budget together for the year, what is the Lord's? What do you want to give? That's between you and the Lord. I'm not going to be checking. But just thinking in terms of ahead, not making a rash vow. Because afterward, if you reconsider it, if you begrudge it, the Lord isn't pleased with that. A wise king sifts out the wicked and brings the threshing wheel over them. Again, the purpose of authority, to winnow out the wicked. The spirit of a man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the inner depths of his heart. Other translations show the conscience of a man, or the Lord shines into a man's soul. The point is that for what man knows the things of man except the spirit of a man which is in him? Even no one knows the things of God except the spirit of God. The Lord is able to use that spirit, or if you want to read conscience in this context, he uses our conscience as a candle to illuminate what's in our heart. And we do something, and it looks good on the outside, but the motive behind it may not be right. Our conscience bothers us, doesn't it? We know we did it with selfish motives. The problem with our conscience is it's something that can be tampered with. You can tweak your conscience. You can harden it. In fact, there are people in the world that actually consider it a boast to be able to do evil and not feel bad about it at all. They think that's good. You know, you go to the airplane and they'll tell you, you know, don't tamper with the smoke detector in the laboratory or you'll incur federal fines. And the smoke detector's there to detect smoke to protect, you know, anything from happening. Well, there are a lot more people that tamper with their conscience, which is God's candle to reveal your sin, and you tamper with that, you're in trouble. Because it searches the inner depths of your heart. The Lord uses that as a candle to look, a lamp. Mercy and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness, he upholds his throne. The glory of young men is their strength, and the splendor of old men is their gray head. The young are naive, but strong. The elderly, though weak, should be wise. As you age and your body slows down, your spirit should be increasing in stature. I mean, think about it. Would you want to go back to the years when you were a teenager? You know, sometimes I've thought, it'd be cool to go back as a teenager knowing what I know now. But I would not want to go back there in those days. You know, I don't care how strong my body was back then in high school. You know, my head was not in the right place. I would not want to go back there. So it's a glory. The splendor of old men is their gray head, the wisdom that comes. Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart. If necessary, the Lord will use those trials and difficulties to speak to us. It's not his first choice, as we pointed out last time. His desire is that we cultivate a sensitivity, that we keep our conscience in good, fine working order, that we're very sensitive to it. Not let Satan overwork it, where we're guilty about every little thing, but that we have a balance of knowing what is right and what is wrong. The Lord can search our hearts. So these are some passages that I think just really open the eyes to see a little more insightful into the human condition, where we are, you know, where our minds and our hearts are, a little self-evaluation, which is helpful. And God uses not only his word here, but also others that can search those things out.